Chapter 21. After a bouncy 4-hour ride across the mountains and steppes of central Mongolia, traversing a road that barely qualified as a pair of ruts, Commerce Minister Shinje was convinced his trek was a wild goose chase. There was no magic supply of oil hiding in Mongolia. He had seen not a single oil well during the entire trip. It was President Fei's fault, foolishly charging at windmills rather than accepting reality. Only Shinje had inherited the Don Quixote outfit. The commerce minister waited angrily for his driver to pull up to the next gur, half expecting the president of Avarga Oil to welcome him on a broken-down pony. His anger and disgust softened rapidly when the dusty caravan rolled through the iron gates and into the stately compound of Tolgoy Borjin. Arriving at such an outpost in the middle of nowhere suddenly gave a jolt of credence to their journey, and pulling up to the front of the elegant residence, Shinje could see that Borjin was no sheepherder. The host was dressed in a finely cut European suit and bowed deeply as Shinje exited the vehicle. A translator at his side relayed his greetings in Mandarin. "Welcome, Minister Shinje. I trust your journey was pleasant." "A delight to see the beautiful Mongolian countryside," Shinje replied, maintaining his diplomatic form as he rubbed dust from his eyes. "May I present my sister Tatiana, who is our director of field operations?" Tatiana bowed gracefully to Shinje, who noted she wore the same look of conceit that Borjin carried. Shinje smiled warmly, then dutifully introduced his entourage. He turned and admired a contingent of horsemen in warrior attire that ringed the driveway. "I have heard much about the Mongol horse," Shinje said. "Do you breed horses, Mr. Borjin?"
"Just a small stock for my security detail. I require that all my security employees be proficient in horsemanship and expert marksmen with the bow."
"An interesting testament to the past," Shinje said.
"A practical one as well. In these parts, a Mongol horse can go where no vehicle can. And some skills of warfare never lose their value. Modern technology is well and fine, but my ancestors conquered half the world with the horse and bow. I find they are still perfectly useful skills today. Please, let us escape this infernal wind and relax indoors," Borjin said, leading the group through the front door. He then led the group down the main hallway toward the large room at the end. Admiring the array of antiques decorating the corridor, Shinje stopped in front of a bronze sculpture of a prancing horse. The patinated green stallion was reflected off a colorful framed mosaic mounted on the wall.
"A lovely sculpture," Shinje said, recognizing the design as Chinese.
"Yuan Dynasty?"
"No. The Song Dynasty of slightly earlier," Borjin replied, impressed with the minister's eye. "Most of the antiques in the house date from the early 13th century, a time of the greatest conquests in Mongol history. The tile mosaic on the wall is an ancient work from Samarkand, and the carved pedestal on which the sculpture sits is from India, circa 1200 AD. "Are you a collector?"
"Not officially," the minister smiled.
"I possess a few modest pieces of porcelain from the Yuan and Ming dynasties, but that is all. I am very impressed with your collection. Objects from that era are not readily marketed."
"I have an antiquities dealer in Hong Kong," Borjin explained with a flat look.
The entourage reached the conference room at the end of the corridor. Its huge floor-to-ceiling windows normally offered an expansive view from the hilltop, but little could be seen beyond the courtyard and sanctuary just below. The strong winds obscured most of the vista with swirling dust, the distant steps peeking through the haze at only random intervals. Borjin strolled past a sitting area with couches and a bar, leading the group to a formal mahogany table where everyone was seated. Borjin took a seat at one end with his back to the wall. Behind him was a wide set of shelves that displayed a medieval arsenal. A collection of ancient spears, lances, and swords lined half the wall, while several handmade composite bows and metal-tipped arrows were hung opposite. Round metal helmets spiked with horsehair plumes lined the top shelf, fronted by several round clay objects that resembled primitive hand grenades. Guarding the entire collection was a huge stuffed falcon, its wings spread ominously at full breadth. The bird's head was tilted upward and its sharp beak pried open, as if it were shrieking a final cry of death. Shinja looked from the weapons to the falcon and then to the man who owned them and felt an involuntary shiver. There was something about the oil executive that was savage like the falcon. The cold eyes seemed to hint at a hidden brutality. Shinja imagined that his host could pull one of the spears from the wall and thrust it through a man without a second thought. As a cup of hot tea was placed before him, the Commerce Minister tried to dispel his feelings and focus on the purpose of his visit. "My government has received your proposal to supply a significant quantity of crude oil to our country. The party leadership is grateful for your offer and most intrigued by the bountiful nature of the proposal. On behalf of the party, I have been asked to confirm the validity of the proposal and discuss the remuneration necessary to conclude an agreement." Borjin leaned back in his chair and laughed. "Yes, of course. Why does Mongolia, nemesis to Cathay for 1,000 years, suddenly desire to assist our uneasy neighbor to the south? How can a dust-laden receptacle of sand and grass, inhabited by ragtag peasants and sheepherders, suddenly materialize as a major source of natural resources? I will tell you why. It is because you made us prisoners in our own land. You and the Russians have barricaded us from the rest of the world for decades. We have become an isolated wasteland, a landlocked island of a forgotten time and place. Well, I'm afraid those days are over, Minister Shinja. You see, Mongolia is a rich land in more ways than one, and you didn't take the time or effort to appreciate that when you had the chance. Only now, Western companies are clamoring to come in and develop our mines and cut timber from our forests. But they are too late for the oil. For when nobody was even interested in prospecting our grounds, we made the effort ourselves. And now we shall reap the rewards. He nodded at Tatiana, who retrieved a map from a side bureau and unrolled it in front of the Chinese minister. She plucked a pair of jade carvings from the center of the table and used them to hold open the scrolled chart. It was a country map of Mongolia. An irregular red oval was overlaid on a section near the southeastern border, appearing like an amoeba that had drowned in a cheap Merlot. The spot stretched for nearly 50 miles, its lower end rounding alongside the border of Chinese Inner Mongolia. "The Temujin Field, a natural basin that makes your aging Dacheng Field look like a bowl of spit," Borjin said, referring to China's largest oil field, which was in a state of decline. "Our test wells indicate potential reserves of 40 billion barrels of crude oil and 50 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. The million barrels a day we will send to you will be a pittance." "Why has such a discovery not been publicized?" Shinja asked with a hint of skepticism. "I have heard nothing of such a find so close to our borders." Borjin smiled, his teeth bared in a shark-like grin. Few living people outside of this room are aware of the find, he said cryptically. My own government knows nothing of these reserves. How else do you think I was able to acquire the entire land rights to the region? There have been minor exploratory forays into Mongolia that have touched upon the oil potential, but they have all missed the primary bonanza, if you will. A proprietary technology of ours helped pinpoint the windfall somewhat by accident, he said with a smile. These are deep reserves, which explains in part why they were overlooked by previous exploration teams. But I need not bore you with the details. Suffice it to say that a number of test wells have provided initial confirmation of the reserve estimates. Shinja sat quietly, the color draining from his face. He had little choice but to acknowledge the reality of the vast oil field. The fact that an arrogant charlatan of questionable morality controlled it made him sick to his stomach. Shinja was playing a weak hand, and he knew that Borjin controlled the deck. Having oil in the ground is one thing, but delivering it within 90 days is quite another, the minister said soberly. Your offer suggests we could see crude oil flowing within that time frame. I don't see how that is possible. It will take some doing on your part, but it is quite feasible, Borjin replied. Turning to Tatiana, he asked for another map from the bureau. She unrolled a second chart which showed a map of Mongolia and northern China. A spiderweb of red lines crisscrossed the Chinese section of the map. The existing oil pipelines of China, Borjin explained. Take a look at your recently completed northeast pipeline from Daqing to Beijing, with a spur from the port terminal at Qinhuangdao. Shinja studied the map, noting a small X along a barren stretch of pipeline that ran through Inner Mongolia. The X is 30 kilometers from the Mongolian border and 40 kilometers from a nearly completed pipeline span I am building to the border. You need only extend the pipeline from my termination to that spot on your Daqing line, and the oil will begin to flow. 40 kilometers of pipeline? That can't be completed in 90 days. Borjin stood up and paced around the table. Come now. The Americans laid 10 miles of rail track in a day constructing their transcontinental railroad in the 1860s. I have taken the liberty of already surveying the route and have the necessary pipe committed from a supplier. For additional consideration, I can also provide temporary excavation equipment. Surely for the country that has built the Three Gorges Dam, this should be child's play. You seem to have considered our needs well, Shinja said with veiled contempt. As a good business partner should. Borjin smiled. And in return, my demands are simple. You will pay a per-barrel rate of 146,000 to Grug, or $125 U.S. You will accede the lands of southern Mongolia, or the Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region, as you inanely refer to the territory. And you will provide me a direct and exclusive pipeline to the port of Qinhuangdao, where you will provide me an offloading port facility where I may export my excess supply of oil. As Shinja gasped at the demand, the Mongol turned and gazed out the window, watching the winds swirl like tongues of fire. A movement caught his eye and he peered down at the courtyard. Two men dressed in dark suits were sprinting across it toward the sanctuary. Borjin watched as the two figures looped around the backside of the structure, then reappeared by the entrance and ducked inside. A tightness gripped his throat as he turned to the minister.
"If you will excuse me for a moment, I must attend to an urgent matter."
Turning his back before the minister could say another word, Borjin strode briskly from the room.